Well, hi, and welcome to today's webinar. It's part of the Kynexus Continuous Improvement webinar series. It's titled today, No More Flavor of the Month! Exclamation point. Learn how to deliver sustainable change. And it's going to be presented by Lynn Kelly. You'll learn more about Lynn in a moment. I'm Mark Raven, a senior advisor with Kynexus. I want to thank you for joining us today. If it's your first time attending a Kynexus webinar, just want to invite you to visit our website at kynexus.com to learn more about our software platform that helps you spread continuous improvement. We're passionate about that at Kynexus, and that's why we're happy to host this webinar series. Let me introduce today's presenter, Lynn Kelly. So following a career highlighted by leadership roles in engineering, supply chain, and continuous improvement across various industries, Lynn retired from Union Pacific Railroad in 2018. Now serving as a senior advisor to BBH Capital Partners, she assists in sourcing, investment evaluation, transaction execution, and providing post-investment oversight to the firm's portfolio companies. At Union Pacific, Lynn was Senior Vice President of Supply Chain and Continuous Improvement. She was also the executive co-owner of the company's innovation program. Before joining Union Pacific, Lynn was Vice President of Operational Excellence, an officer, and a member of the executive leadership team at Textron. Lynn holds a PhD in evaluation and research, and she taught undergraduate and graduate statistics courses. Before becoming a professor, she held the positions of Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Doctors Hospital in Detroit. So I know we have attendees coming from healthcare and manufacturing and different industries. So given Lynn's background and experience, I know there's something here for everybody today. So with that, Lynn, I will turn things over to you. Thank you again for doing the session today.
Thank you, Mark. All right, here we go. So New Year's resolutions, we're going to start talking about change right off the bat. I don't know how many of you make New Year's resolutions, but you know, I do maybe every other year. And the thing about New Year's resolutions is that they're pretty hard to keep. So I want you to put in the chat, what do you think the probability is or the percentage of people who keep their New Year's resolutions? Just throw it in there. We'll have Mark read us a couple of those numbers.
Yeah. So we've got some responses, 14, 10, 2, 10, 7, 5, 25, 8, 15, 10, 30, 5. Okay. Less than, consensus is a low, if not single digit number, Lynn.
Yeah, and you're pretty right on there. So the average percentage is 9%. And in fact, by the end of January, 23% of people abandon their resolutions. And by the end of January, it's 43% abandon their resolutions altogether. So you'd say, you know, we're talking about change, right? We're talking about personal change. And you can say, well, yeah, you know, it kind of makes sense that it would be so low because, you know, you save up all year. I know for me, if I'm thinking, geez, I should work out today, but it's December and I think, oh, but my New Year's resolution is going to be to work out more. You know, I'll start on January 1. Like we save up and on something that's usually pretty big and pretty major. But what about like something the night before? Like this, like Clocky. I don't know how many of you who know about Clocky, but you can kind of guess what it does. You put it next to your bed, the alarm clock goes off, and you have to get up and chase it. And some of you may have a Clocky. I've talked to someone who had one, and she said, yeah, it works. She chases it, but then she hits the snooze and sleeps next to it. And after like three chases, she's up. But the point is that personal change is really hard, right? I mean, and then you think about organizational change and you think, wow, these are people who have not a big vested interest in changing, and they're getting a corporate change rolled out to them that often they haven't participated in. You know, how likely is that to fail or even to succeed? So now it's your turn again in the chat. What percentage do you think of organizational change fails?
All right, let's see what people have to say here. 40%, 70, 90. This is the percentage that fails. 75, 10, 70, 50, 70, 97, 50, 75, 80. So the consensus on the failure rate is relatively high.
Yeah. And now I'm going to throw in my disclaimer with a little story. So I was responsible for change at Textron, and I had just been hired by the company because I had been involved at change in the state of Michigan in some automotive fastener plants. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to implement something way back in the year 1998 called TQM, which is a precursor to lean, in their automotive plants. And they had 12 in the state of Michigan. So I helped them develop the program, like 5S on the shop floor. And they went on to win the Michigan Quality Leadership Award. So then Textron, the company Textron, came in and said, well, we want to buy this company because we're building a fastener brand globally in the automotive industry. So then Textron came to me and said, how about you move to Paris, France, and you roll out what you did in Michigan in France and Germany? And I was a stats professor at the time, but I had studied lean and TQM and had been to Japan at Toyota. And I said, yeah, my youngest was in college. I said, I'm there. So I rolled out change, this new kind of precursor to lean, in the German factories, about five over there, and in the French factories, there were five or six over there. And I found that I failed miserably in the French plants, but the German plants were pretty good. And the reasons are lots, mostly because their customers, Mercedes and BMW over in Germany, wanted them to be more like Toyota, one of their suppliers to be, and the French companies weren't there yet. But I failed. But I had a 50% success rate, but I'm talking to my boss and, you know, it's not looking so great. So that's started me on the journey of studying change. So I was studying change, and what I realized was that I was actually not doing so bad. So right around 2000, there was an HBR article, and it was called Cracking the Code of Change. And the author said, here's the brutal truth, 70% of all organizational change fails. And I went, wow, if it's in HBR, it must be true. Now, some of you now, I could probably see the chat filling up, are going to dispute that number. And I can tell you, I've done the research since then, and I have found lots of different numbers, depending on studies, but most of them range between a failure rate of 70% and 50%. So the best you could do is about 50%. So in any case, even if it's only 50%, it's too high when you think of putting resources in an effort and asking people to buy in, because when it fails, we leave damaged goods behind. We have people who no longer believe, and that's where flavor of the month comes in, and the next change is harder. So here's another study that I want you to answer this one. When does the failure begin to take place? And let me frame this for you. How soon could you detect the difference between if it's going to fail or succeed? Go ahead and give me your numbers. How long after you implement?
We'll look for responses come in within a month, within 6 months. Response, 1 month, 3 months, 6 to 8 weeks, within 6 months, almost immediately based on how management reacts to it. Within 3 months. Yeah. So early. Okay.
So early, yeah. And I'm surprised because a lot of people think it's much longer, but it's actually within the first month. And this was a study done, and it really showed that there are enough little hints along the way that in the first month, you can start to detect if your change will fail or whether it will succeed. And that's important because what we're going to talk about, and I'll introduce the change questions in a few minutes, but what we're going to talk about is how do we detect failure early so we can pivot, so that we can fix it, so that we don't have to end up with that, you know, 70% failure rate. And why does organizational change fail? Just throw out a few reasons. Everybody give me your top one, and let me get a couple of those in here.
Look for responses in the chat again. Commitment, poor sponsorship, org not aligned, follow through, leadership, top level distraction, fear of change or more work, not getting the voice of the customer, change management issues, poor communication.
Good. Yeah. You got most of the top ones. So, excuse me. So, you can see now in this little logo that John Shook and I, put together. These are the key categories that that we believe the change fails, or else there are success factors that you can build into these categories to make them your change succeed. So purpose, designing and doing the work, engaging and developing the employees, management system and leadership, and then culture, which kind of radiates into all of them. So we will go through something like this question mark in the order that it is. But what we ask people is, once you learn the change questions, you can go in any order that makes sense for you. We like to start with purpose, but after that, you know, this is a very flexible methodology. So let me tell you how we got there with this methodology. I'll give you my story and then give you John's story very briefly. But basically, you heard that I failed. I failed a lot. I mean, I've been doing change now for a multitude of years, 12 years at Textron. And Textron, if you don't know them, they own Bell Helicopter, Cessna Aircraft, EasyGo Golf Cars. I was in the mining industry in South Africa and Australia, and then, of course, automotive, where I was based in France. So lots of different businesses. And I was always doing change. Eventually, I reported to the chairman and CEO and was responsible throughout the whole organization, and, you know, kept making mistakes and failing and trying to figure it out. And every time I failed or made a mistake, I researched, okay, what could I do differently next time? And I really did go to the research. I went to peer-reviewed research. I tried to find out, and I came up with a list of 11 questions that, you know, they were building. First it was 3, and then it was 4, and then it got to be 11. And they fell in these categories, these 5 categories. And as I was, then what happened was, every time I'd implement a change, I'd go through this list of questions and I would say, is this applicable? Is this one? And I ended up then, after answering the ones that were applicable, with a customized approach to change for that particular change, which would be probably different than the next change I implemented. But I saw my success rate in terms of sustainment and delivering consistent results go up, up, up. And we'll get to at the very last slide, I'll tell you the punchline, the results. But it was very powerful and it worked. And during COVID, I was going to write a book. I thought, people said to me, you should write a book. And I thought, well, yeah, you know what? I think I kind of figured something out here. And when I'm no longer really as active in the workforce anymore, and it's just going to go with me. So John Shook and I served on a board together. And during COVID, we had a board call and we started talking afterwards. And I said, what are you doing during COVID? And he said, I'm writing a book. And he says, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing a book. What's yours about? Change. Hey, wait a minute. Mine's about change. And so then we said, well, let's be writing buddies. Let's each write our own book, but we'll write a chapter a month, share them, and give each other critique. And it only took us 2 months to figure out we were really writing the same book. So essentially, through the course of his career, and also being the head of the Lean Global Network, and seeing Lean successes and failures in multiple countries, he came up with this whole list himself, which, when we overlaid them, we had about 85-90% overlap. And what I was missing, he had, and what he was missing, I had. So that's thus the change questions. So anyway, that's kind of the origin of them. Now let's talk about how to use them. Basically, you can use them several ways. You can read the book and you can go through and pick the ones you want. Because I was working at Textron in 32 different countries, I had a digital version, which was a clunky Excel version, but it worked because before Zoom, we were doing stuff over the phone with Teams, and then we all had a version of this. Well, if you wanted, this is free, changequestions.net. You could download the digital workbook. It's about a 40-page document. It's fillable PDF. It takes you through the 11 questions. It has a you know, pages for team action items, all kinds of things. We want you to use it. It's there for you to use. John and I wanted to make this free. You can decide to buy the book or not. The book is 200 and something pages. So, you know, you get stories, you get more background, you get a lot of examples in the book. But if you can do it with this, go for it. So that's how you use the change questions. And the idea is, no two organizational change efforts are the same. So why should your approach be? And these questions will deliver a customized approach for every change. And I have to do my disclaimer here. I have to tell you, though, the methodologies that are out there, They're very good. I don't want to take anything away from them. This is just a different approach. And if this works for you, we hope you enjoy it and try it and it works. Okay. My last job before I retired was Union Pacific Railroad. They came to me and said, we want to do lean on the railroad. So 42,000 employees in the operating department is where they wanted to do it. You know, never under a roof. You know, how do you think about lean in a railroad? So they had already kind of named their lean approach and they called it UP Way. And by the way, this railroad story is the case study that goes through the books, through the whole book. So in the book, you know, we talk about how when I was hired, what happened and all of the, you know, near failures and then the misunderstandings and, you know, all of the things that happened and trying to get buy-in with a lot of people who, when I would say we're going to do lean, they'd say, what? What's lean? So it was a wonderful journey. But they had named it the UP Way. And this is, you can see the elements of UP Way. They wanted to engage employees. That was the number one thing the CEO told me, but also to continuously improve. They wanted to improve safety, productivity, but also customer satisfaction. So that's kind of the case study, and the examples that are in the digital workbook follow the case study. Okay, here's a change question. This is the first one. So the first one is, what is a situational problem you want to solve with the change initiative? And when you answer that question, it gives you a purpose statement. And normally, although we say you can move all the other change questions around and skip the ones that don't apply, this is one that we think is important. And the thing is, if you already know the answer, it takes a minute. Sometimes I teach this in large groups and, you know, the people that, you know, I say, if you know the answer to this, you can write it in a minute. And sure enough, boop, 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 they put it into the digital workbook. But the people that have to think about it, that those are the times that you absolutely need this question. But we say, define it anyway, because you want all of your team that's going to help you implement to know what the purpose is. You want leadership to know it. Make sure they buy into it before you go any further down this path. So we do ask that you start off with a purpose statement. And why do we do that? Well, okay, I'm going to go back to two-year-old, three-year-olds. Kind of every age, toddlers are known for something. Terrible twos are our good two-year-olds or terrible twos. The three-year-olds are known for asking why. In fact, they ask why about 8 times a day. I mean, it doesn't matter, morning, noon, and night. They're going to ask why they don't take a break for holidays. Some of them, I read some studies that say they keep going on up until they're 10 and 12 years old. Some of them ask 30 times a day. So consider yourself lucky if you're only getting the 8 times a day. But consider it. It's an innate need. We have, when we're just 3 years old, we have a need to understand what we see, what we experience in the world around us. We want to know why. So then you might think, well, maybe it doesn't carry on into the workplace, but it does. And out of all the groups, there's been a lot of studies on purpose in the workplace. One of the studies that was done by PwC said that out of all the groups, the millennials have the strongest need to understand why. And when you think about the idea of purpose, if people need to know, understand why just for doing their day-to-day work, think about how much greater that need is when we're asking them to change something, to do something differently, to maybe take a little time to learn something new. You know, think about your own New Year's resolution. You know, it's really, really hard. And why do we make it harder for them? Give them the purpose. Let's respect them enough to say, here's the purpose. We know you need it. We're going to tell you what the purpose of this change, why we're asking you to do something differently. Okay, so now I just wanted to show you the digital workbook. This is page 8 of it, and it's much bigger than this, but we've given you some hints. In the digital workbook, you'll get agendas, meeting agendas, sample agendas, deliverables, suggestions of who you could invite to your meetings. But on this, the very beginning, the purpose statement, we say often they're structured as a two-part sentence. You probably will have, you know, something like what it is, what are you going to initiate or implement, and then why. So you've got this nice, robust purpose statement. And then as an example, if you were on in the PDF right now, you could type your purpose statement in here and you could play with it and save it to your own computer and use it. So you start off with the purpose statement. There's another section to purpose, another question you'd ask that has to do with value. In other words, what is the value that you expect to get from the change? But we're going to skip that and go right to design, do, and improve the work. And in this section, we're going to start with a story. So I told you about beginning at Textron. And so let me just expand on that story. So When I ended up my last job is I was reporting the chairman and CEO, and I was rolling out big changes like a supplier portal for all the aerospace businesses. So lots of changes that touched a lot of people. And then I had a small change, and it was a group of about 250 people who I thought, you know, we had a really good relationship. They trusted me. I knew almost all of them, probably only 10 different countries, not a lot of different countries, and the CEO wanted it done. So I had a meeting with the leaders of those 250 people group, and I said, hey, you know, the CEO wants us to do this. You know, let's talk about it a little bit, but we, you know, we probably need to just, you know, just do it. But I want to hear your input. And people didn't really oppose it, maybe because I said CEO, but they didn't really oppose it. And I said, okay, well, we'll just see. And then no one came to me afterwards and said they weren't in favor of it. And so, you know, I was getting arrogant. My success rate of change was going up. And I thought, hey, I'm not even going to ask myself the change questions on this one. I got this. They all know me. They trust me. I'm just gonna roll it out. And so I did an email. Again, really? Did an email. Effective, blah, blah. This is a change. And I got slammed. I really got slammed. And so I read a study. And the next slide is going to tell you about the study. But this picture is here for a reason. That weekend, I researched, okay, why was the blowback so great? Well, I can't imagine what these are I know these people. And I found a study and I went, oh my goodness, huh? And I was mulling this over. And then my girlfriend had invited me to go to Martha's Vineyard for the weekend with her. So we were on a little bay like this. And this isn't the exact picture, but I had to find some bay later on that showed what it looked like. So visualize that we are walking on the grassy part. There's a trail that goes around the top. And we're looking down, and if we were looking at the far side, or actually the right side of the bay, and suddenly there's like 10, 11 people. And they come walking along this beach, this abandoned, deserted beach. They're clearly going to go swimming. They have swimsuits on. They're carrying their inner tubes. They're walking. They're walking, walking. They walk all the way around the bay, and they get to the far end. And then suddenly, one guy just ran and just jumped in. And I said to my friend, are you kidding me? Like, well, they were looking for the perfect part of this deserted beach. It all looks the same. Well, and she said, no. It's the riptide. There's a riptide here that instead of taking you out to sea, takes you across. So they can actually cross the bay and end up at the other side. And sure enough, the guy is flying. And then somebody else jumps in after him flying. Then there were like four or five people on inner tubes, and they plopped in and let the water take them along. And then there's a couple of people left. And the first person kind of went up to her knees and went like this. And then the two of them, three of them, whatever it was, walked all the way back around to meet their friends. And I just realized that I just saw the change curve play out in front of my eyes. And that was a true story. I didn't embellish it at all. And that is that in any given group in general, 20% of the people will accept change. 60% will be neutral. They'll just be floating along, going where the current takes them, not paddling, not resisting, just floating. And then 20% will not be open to the change initially. And then I realized, oh my gosh. So in this group, I rolled it out to everybody at the same time. Who has the loudest voice? The people who really don't want to do it. Who do I need? I need the neutrals, because the people who accept change are probably there with me. And because the people who really don't want to do it, I have the loudest voice, they'll probably pull that neutral group over. And, you know, I had already read The Tipping Point, and I love this quote. I just read it. I love you read it. Make sure you read it as I'm talking, because It's true. I mean, you need, when you're thinking about change, you need the neutrals. You have to get the tipping point and you want to get it going in the right direction. And if you start off to everybody at the same time, then often you'll get it going in the wrong direction, and trying to reverse that is very, very difficult. So then I added a new change question, and it was, how can I pilot this? How can I pilot the idea with change agents? So in other words, if I have to do a change, I try, even if it's kind of convoluted, I try to find any way I can do a pilot, an experiment, or even a simulation, something that I could get the bugs out, right? Because every time you have bugs, people who resist will take everybody over towards them. So try to get the bugs out, make sure. And also, you know, we should respect people enough that we don't give them something that's full of problems. They shouldn't have to figure those problems out. We have to figure those out. So I try to do anything I can to test it out ahead of time. And if I have a choice, I try to test it out with people who I know are open to change. Because then another change question is, how can I recognize success? And remember, we know in the first month, we can detect if it's going to fail or succeed. So right away, I start looking to detect, is it failing? Is it succeeding? And when I find those successes, we publicize them. We have the CEO talk about it, the manager, the leaders, we have them present, we do a podcast, an article. And suddenly, we have fear of missing out. We have FOMO. The middle group goes, hey, I want that. How come they get to do that? How come they get all those resources? How come they get this? And then we've got it going in the right direction. And so that's part of one of the lessons I learned, and just kind of introduced another change question to you. Okay, engage and develop employees. We all know that. And we're going to start with, we're going to talk about recognition. A big part of engage and develop employees is communication. The two primary reasons the change fails, and you can see it, it's either one or the other in almost every study, is either leadership commitment, visible leadership commitment, lack of that will make it fail, and having it will help it succeed, and communication. So communication's big, and I don't cover it now because there's actually several change questions involved in communication, and we talk about things like, we have to gather frequently asked questions and answer them before we even announce the change. Let's not let managers make those things up. We owe them the answers, a communication plan. And so now we get to recognition. Recognition is part of communication. So let's look at this quote. So in this quote, it says 66% of employees are likely to leave their jobs because they don't feel appreciated. And the figure is higher among millennials, with 8 out of 10. So again, think about it. If they're not recognized in their job, we're not even asking them to change. We're just giving them their job, their normal day to day. If they're not recognized, they're likely to think about leaving because they don't feel appreciated. But then when you go further with that, and you think we're asking them to change, we want them to do things differently, and we're not recognizing them. A lot of times, we don't even think about recognizing the successes until we have a bunch of them. Like, why do we wait so long? Let's plan recognition ahead of time. So I'm big on recognition, but talk about pigeons playing ping pong. Because that also talks about incentives. I like recognition better than incentives. But B.F. Skinner, we know about, many of us have known about his studies and behavioral conditioning. And would you believe he actually taught pigeons how to play ping pong? And if you Google it, one of his videos is on YouTube, and you'll see pigeons are playing ping pong. And he did that with incentives. So if he can teach pigeons to play ping pong with incentives, I think we can get change with rewards, recognitions, and letting people know we value them and value the way they're participating in the change. I got to tell you one other thing about this because it's so cool. He actually taught pigeons to read. Like, I mean, that's mind-boggling, right? And you can Google a video of that too. And it's not rocket science. I mean, they're not reading War and Peace, but they have a pigeon looking at a screen, and the word turn comes up, and the pigeon goes in a circle, and then the word peck comes up and the pigeon pecks. So can you believe it? I mean, we think we're so smart, but you know, if you can do that with pigeons, you know, we can do a lot with rewards and recognition. All right. So that's another change question. And now we're on management system and leadership. And I heard a couple of you mention that in the chat when you talked about reasons for success or failure. Okay. So this is a study there's a ton of studies on this, but I'm going to give you one because it's pretty profound. So now we know that, you know, approximately, okay, again, we're probably going to want to, somebody's probably going to raise discussion on all the percentages, but let's say that it was 30% of failure of change that succeeded, and that's in the green, and the rest failed, let's say 70%, but let's say it was even 50. So this particular study was done by McKinsey, and actually the McKinsey study did find, because McKinsey studied this too, they did find 70% in their study by asking a question, and they defined failure as anything that didn't meet or mostly meet the expectations for the change. So that was the way they defined it, and it's 70%. Out of that group, 33% of the times that it failed, it was because management behaviors did not support the change. And this is important because a lot of times when we look at managers, we say, well, they visibly support it. And you know what? Yeah, usually they do because they're supposed to, because their bosses tell them, at least to you, at least to their boss or whomever. But it's their behavior that gives the signals to people, is this something we're going to do or not? So one of the change questions doesn't ask managers if they support the change. One of the change questions says to managers, how can you show visible support of this change? It does ask, do you support this change? And if not, why and what would it take for you to support it? But then it goes on to say, okay, how can you visibly show your people you support the change? And we ask them to think of ideas because, you know what, think about psychologically. Now you're not telling them how to visibly support. They're in their mind already visualizing themselves with the change, and they're visualizing how they're going to support it. And you're giving them a little bit of autonomy, because another great quote is people, I love it, people accept what they help to create. So you're helping them to create their thought of how they're visually going to support the change. So that's why we don't just say, did management buy in? We want to know how they're visibly going to support the change. And then we're into culture. And culture, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Let me go back. Sorry. Culture permeates all of the other areas. And so what we do with culture is we have found ways to build in culture amongst each of the change questions. So for instance, in design, do and improve the work. When you're designing the work, you're actually asked to look at the context or the culture in which it takes place. You're constantly thinking, frequently asked questions. You're gonna have tidbits of culture all throughout. But this is a catch-all because culture is so critical, and it's really hard to change culture. So like, don't even think right out of the gate you're gonna change culture. You may, that may be part of it, but it's often really difficult. So you wanna try to use culture. So what we do in this question is we ask you, define your culture high level, and you know, and then we say, how could you leverage the culture to help support the change? And there's ways to do that. And then, is there anything that could prohibit your change from being effective? And how can you mitigate that risk? How can you think about how you can mitigate it if you haven't already done it in the other change questions? So that's that piece where we recognize the power of culture, and we try to think about how we could use it for our benefit and how we can mitigate the risk of it making our change successful. Okay, implementation, yet another one of my many failures. So I rolled out a big change. And I had, as a lot of our implement, I created the implementation plan, and a lot of our implementation plans are the same. Mine was very typical. It was by this date, blah, blah, blah will happen. Everybody will do this by this date. Everybody will do this, you know, and going on. And this was early in my career with Textron in implementing change. And so I did that. And then the change failed. And so I try to go back and see, well, where in the process did the change fail? And it turned out that it failed really like early on. Like there was something, remember I said, we need to test the change to make sure that we get all the bugs out. So we don't ask for people to try to get the bugs out in addition to changing. Well, there was kind of a fatal flaw in the change itself, right at the beginning of the implementation. And I didn't really detect it. And so there is a change question about detecting it early. But this has to do with what kind of implementation plan you have. When you get to the point where you're implementing, there's been a study, and again, it's an HBR study. The quote is at the bottom. It's Harvard Business Review. And there were 300 and something companies studied. And what they found was that they were all implementing change. And there were two different ways they implemented. The one was called operational speed. And that was a timeline-based, you know, do this by this date. It was timeline-based by date due. The other, and you know, moderately successful. The other one was, they named that operational speed. The other one they named strategic speed. And what they said with this is they had checkpoints throughout this implementation plan. And the implementation plan was not marching orders. It wasn't mandatory, do this by this date. It was, now we need you to check, or we will check, is it delivering the results we expect it to? If not, we've got to tweak it. We might have to pivot. We have to do this, but we want this change to be successful. So we'll do what we have to do to make it work. And that was called strategic speed. And what they found is, I meant to look at the study right before this webinar to find out, it was either 2 or 3 years later, but it was a period of time. I think it was 2 years later. They went back to all these companies and they said, you know, how satisfied were you with the results of your initiative? And there were 52% better results in the companies, the organizations that used strategic speed. And so now what I always do when I get to implementation plan is I make sure I've incorporated those little checkpoints. And remember how soon can we detect change? Within a month. So right in the first month, I'm checking, or we're checking, the team is checking, and we're finding out, are we going to be successful? And if not, we figure out why not. And you know, I know what I'm saying sounds like it takes a lot of energy, but it takes a whole lot more energy if we fail. So, and we leave damage behind when we fail every single time. So the reason for the change questions is to put the time and effort in before we even announce a change, before we implement it, to plan it so that it is planned for success. And when we wrote that up in the book, I said it like that. You know, we kind of put the time in ahead of time. John Shook said, no, it's not that we put the time in ahead of time. We consider that part of the change. So if this is the part of change that we always think we are going to implement, this front part is the part of the change too. It's the necessary part of the change. And again, you know, if you don't have a big change and it doesn't require a lot of the change questions answered, it's really simple and fast, but at least you've mitigated some of the issues. Okay, now I promised that I would get to kind of the punchline. All right, so this is, you know, I went with the 70% because I, you know, again, whatever. I could have put 30 to 50%, but average across multiple industries, organizations, and countries, let's say worst case scenario, 30%, only 30% of change is effective. By the time I left Textron, I was at, for all the changes that I was responsible, all of these were with teams. I always had a team. I was the common denominator, and the change questions was the common denominator. But the teams and I were 90% effective and in being successful. And I'm going to talk to you about how we measured sustainment because we were very rigorous. So I'll tell you in a second. And at Union Pacific, over hundreds of changes when I left Union Pacific, we were at 96% sustainment rate. So it shows that we can beat the odds. I mean, it really does. So now look at the little note at the bottom, and I can elaborate on it if you want to, because there was so much more than this. We did a lot around sustainment. We changed process owners' name to, we called them sustainers, and we didn't say projects closed, they transitioned. We, you know, changed language. We did a lot of different things, but the way that we measured sustainment or success was that we had to have at least 6 consecutive months at or above the metric of the KPI that we were tracking, that we were trying to change. It had to be at or above that for six consecutive months. And if it wasn't, they only had a year to get there. Now, it didn't, remember, we kept checking in between. So we may check it month two. And if it looked like we were dropping, then we would jump in and we work with the process owner or the sustainer, and we'd figure out what do we need to do. But a lot of these measurements in the railroad are electronic, because every time you move a train, every time a train stops, it's all electronic. So you can't fudge the numbers. So basically, nobody was messing with the numbers, and we were actually able to get this. And if you know, they had a derailment, we'd give them an extension. I mean, there were different rules behind that, but basically that in essence was the guideline that we followed. And those are those sustainment rates over hundreds of different initiatives in all different areas. So I think you told me I had 40 minutes and I went over by 2 minutes, so.
Oh, I think you're right about spot on, because you started a couple minutes.
Oh, okay.
The top of the hour after the initial intro. So thank you, Lynn. We'll encourage people to continue submitting questions. Please do so using the Q&A button. And before we do that, we've got just a couple quick announcements. You can advance that, please. And We'll come back to
it. Oh, you're making me work some more. I was done.
Sorry. Just a couple clicks. And
there
then,
you go.
All right. Our next webinar is scheduled next month, December 5th, with our very own Stephanie Hill, a senior lean strategist at Kynexus. It's going to be titled Engaging Senior Leaders to Accelerate Your Continuous Improvement Program. Registration is not yet open, but since you are part of today's webinar, you'll receive an email inviting you to register for that webinar, or you can always sign up to be notified if you're watching, let's say, the recording of this at kynexus.com/webinars. So I know Stephanie is going to do a great job next month, and we invite you also to click on that button on the webpage for the Webinars On Demand Library, over 100 webinars for you to view alone or with your team and talk about. A lot of great content there. Next slide, please. We also invite you lots of free resources on the Kynexus website. We have a blog at blog.kynexus.com, a couple of blog posts every week about all things continuous improvement. So we invite you to check that out. And then finally, next slide, our podcast. You see our mascot, Ophi, there with the headphones in the logo. The Kynexus Continuous Improvement Podcast is available through all of the major podcast services, kynexus.com/podcast. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, you heard my discussion with Lynn, the preview of the webinar, and the full audio of today's webinar presentation will be available there in the podcast. Perfect if you want to revisit that on your drive into work one day, or on a flight or on a walk. That audio will be available. Please subscribe to our podcast. All right. So then with that, if you can advance it to the Q&A slide, and you can see Lynn's email address there and the website, changequestions.net. Somebody had put in the chat, the name of the book is Change Questions. So again, changequestions.net. Lynn, a couple questions. First off, kind of going back to the beginning of your presentation with some of the data and some of the studies, it maybe was an opportunity for you to comment on. Does that data refer to large change initiatives as opposed to small kaizens, small changes? Yeah. I mean, the data is really about the large programs, correct?
Right. So what I found in terms of studies is I could not find over the years many studies that dealt with small individual programs or projects. What I found was that most of these studies had to do with kind of an aggregate of companies. Now, what they often ask people is, and when they were doing it, is think about the last change you experienced. And they didn't predefine what size change it had to be. So I think for some of those, we definitely would have some smaller type changes built in. And especially there was one study that was done by, I think it was, it was IBM, and it was change practitioners. Those folks probably would have had smaller studies built in. And by the way, their Their failure rate, they put at 40, I think it was 46%. So they had a little bit better success. They might have been smaller projects too.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard a benchmark related to Toyota or other small Kaizen programs of a 90% implementation rate, meaning, you know, they found something to implement. And Kinexus customers across the board, when we aggregate the data, this includes small, medium, large changes, a lot of small changes are in the range of like 75%, which I think—
Sustainment, you know, you're saying?
Well, sustainment might be a different measure, but I think at least deemed initial success.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
A lot of people in our customer base doing things really, really well. But you know, one other follow-up question. I mean, which it seems like the larger the initiative, maybe the higher the risk, the higher the failure rate. Is there something to be said for trying to take a big initiative and trying to chunk it up into smaller initiatives?
Well, that's my personal belief. So that's always, whenever it's possible, that's always the way I've rolled it out, because a lot of times different circumstances have different things you have to mitigate risk for. So you could, what could work in one country, if it's a large one, a large multinational, or even like at Union Pacific, you know, you've got LA maybe very different from Omaha, Nebraska, right? Or North Platte, Nebraska. So you had different circumstances. And so what we try to do is really do a rolling implementation whenever we could. And then also, you know, people embrace what they helped to create, so we could give local folks an opportunity to not just do plug and play, but help refine the solution for them. So I always believe in that whenever possible. And I would say at Union Pacific, those rates that you saw at Union Pacific were mostly smaller changes. Mm-hmm. It was all of our changes, but there were a lot of, we're doing this in this yard. Okay. And then this in this terminal, which would have been a little bit bigger, and then this across all operating. So you had all different sizes of changes.
Yeah. And then when we talk about failures or failing to meet the goal for a change initiative, does the data tell us the answer, or do you have a sense from your experience, like how often is the failure, like we failed to implement it, we didn't do it, versus we did it and we failed to have impact that we expected?
It's funny because everything that I found lumps those things together. So often the bigger studies that give you actually the percentages that you can kind of, you know, hang your hat on somewhat are things where that they're, people are they're self-defining, whether some of the answers were it sustained or it delivered results, mostly made you happy. And then one of them, then like a middle category would be mixed results. So you know, it's kind of like a hodgepodge in a lot of these big major studies. Now, a lot of the smaller studies that dove into particular areas like leadership, you know, studies that just talked about leadership or just talked about the need for communication or failure because they don't have the capability to do the new work, they weren't trained or didn't have the resources or whatever. Those are often a little bit more deep dive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, Lynn. There's a question here from Katie. Well, part of the answer is clearly because you're such a compelling change agent. Could you please give us some insight on how you manage to maintain focus of management teams who are often pulled in so many different directions? You got a compliment and a question.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the compliment. I think part of it is it gets easier as you build your track record. There's no doubt with that. And then when I started like at Union Pacific, so just think about it. Well, first of all, you probably don't know, but people at Union Pacific don't really leave because up until a couple of years ago, they had an amazing pension plan, including like for a lot of the workers' healthcare. So it wasn't unusual that I'd sit in a room and I'd be introduced to everybody as the newbie, and everybody would say their name, where they worked, and years of service. And I mean, isn't that interesting? That shows how much it's valued. And it wouldn't be unusual to have 20, 30 years of service. So you've got a long serving group of people in your in that world who have think looking at me, I don't know railroads. I know manufacturing. I'm a woman. I'm hired in from the outside. I don't have a network. I don't know anybody in the company. So I had to find change agents. I had to start one at a time. And I started finding like people that believed in it. And I want to tell you a quick story because it's so cool. Yeah, I've got a minute. I'm going to do it in a minute.
No, you're good.
One of the ways, so we wanted to roll out this UP way across all of Union Pacific in the operating department. And there were 22 different service units, which is kind of all where all the one ends on one track and it starts again. So the whole 32,000 track miles was divided up into 22 different service units. And we wanted to pilot it in one in the north, one in the south, and one in the western region. Well, you know, to try to find somebody to volunteer for that or to tap somebody and say, it's going to be you would be really hard. So then what we did, and I didn't know who I could trust and who was a change agent. So what we did is we said to every service unit leader, we're going to do this new thing. It's going to get visibility to the very top. It will improve your operating ratio. It will blah, 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 blah. You're going to get some resources at the beginning. We told them all the good things. And we said, we want you to volunteer if you want to be chosen for the pilot. And, you know, first the change agents started volunteering, but then people were like, ooh, they're volunteering. It's going up to the COO. I better volunteer. And pretty soon everybody had volunteered. Okay. Now, psychologically, you've got everybody volunteering to be a pilot, whether they really want to or not. You've got them now taking that very first step. But now we chose one pilot from each service unit or from each region. Now we're choosing based on everybody telling me who the change agents were. And in the book, I tell you kind of ways to detect a change agent. But, you know, we chose the three service units. Now, all of a sudden, we had some of the ones that volunteered saying, well, how come they got to be chosen? We're going to do it anyway. We don't need you. We're going to do it anyway. I mean, because of FOMO, fear of missing out. So I think there are some things you can do thinking about human psychology, even if you come in as a new person and you don't know anybody and you have to build a track record. There are ways that you can do that just maybe by being a little creative and thinking how can I engage people in this?
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Lynn. There are two questions related to strategic speed. I'm going to just read them both here. They're both short questions. Is it fair to say that strategic speed would equate to using toll gates in your plan? And the second question is just asking, can you speak a little more about strategic speed and checkpoints or maybe share an example?
Good. Okay, good. Okay. So toll gates, yeah, somewhat. I think in some worlds, toll gates have gotten a bad name. But you can think of it kind of the same way. Yeah. What we do is we ask you, I remember I said in purpose section, there's a question about value. So what we often do is think about, okay, what is the actual value we want to get from this change initiative? What is the real value? And then later on, a change question goes, how can we measure that real value? So what happens a lot of times is that, you know, sometimes we say, okay, we want to get this. We want people to use it because it will improve, blah, blah. And then we say, okay, we have to train everybody in the new stuff. So then we make a toll gate or a checkpoint number of people trained. But that's not the value that you just because they're trained. We've stopped short. It's important to know how many people are trained, but we have to know if we're really getting the value. So, you know, then you could say, well, the number of people using it, and maybe you can detect that in the system if it's like a new billing system or something, but it's still not the value. So now what if it's reducing the number of billing errors? Well, now we have to actually go in and check, and it can be a random check and be a spot check. It doesn't have to be 100% of everybody, but basically you go in and you check, one of the ways we did it, let me see, I just don't want to take so much time on questions. Let me do it really quick because I love this. One of the things we did is we had our managers do the training for the early lean tools, and they had to train their own people, but we were there to assist them. And right after the training, during the course, we gave four questions. Do you think this to all the people in their team? Do you think this will engage employees? Do you think it will improve your quality or workplace quality, the quality? Do you think you're going to use it, and do you understand it? Then 3 weeks later, we polled everybody again. Now, all of the surveys were anonymous, but we knew by manager who we were. And now we said, has it improved engagement? Are you using it? So now we're checking to see, did they actually use it? We said, do you still understand it? In other words, does it work for you? And then has it improved any of your metrics? Now we're asking 3 weeks later, and we can tell who's implemented, who hasn't, which managers have given it lip service. So mm-hmm. those types of checks, you asked for an example, those are the types of checks that I'm talking about. And we stop there at that site. If they're not doing it, we go out there and we figure out what's going on.
Yeah. All right, Lynn, maybe we have time for one more question. It's a meaty question, but Gabrielle,
I'll make it short.
Gabrielle okay. asks, I'll try to summarize it, that KPIs are often influenced by outside factors, also by the changes in our processes. Systems deteriorate over time. How can we track KPIs and declare they're sustained over time without kind of understanding outside factors, entropy, if there's not a simple cause and effect between what we did and the change in the measures?
Well, early on, you have to find a way to isolate it, even if it's difficult. I think if you're digging in and, you know, in the design, do and improve the work, we ask you to dig in, actually go to the workplace, see how it's being done. Understand, you could see the outside factors. Ask people, what else influences this? You do a measure and a countermeasure. So in other words, if you know that you could suboptimize this by increasing this, then you maybe measure both of them. It would not be unusual that we would have two metrics that we're tracking at the same time, and they both have to stay solid. But I also don't believe in measuring through all eternity, because then we build bureaucracy. So I feel like we threw a dart at it. We couldn't find research behind it, but we said we're measuring at least 6 months of sustainment. And since a lot of these are key metrics, if it's a KPI, it's a key metric for the leader anyway, they're probably going to still measure, but we're not going to actively measure. And then some things do happen that take it backwards. But if it's a true KPI, somebody who's a leadership position, if they care about the KPI, they're going to flag it. And hopefully they would call, we will often get called back in. Okay, we had a derailment. Now we've had changes in the way the work is done. We got to get back. We need a reboot, and we would do that. That is a very meaty question, and I could talk for a long time about it. But I hope I gave you a few snippets.
Yeah. Well, and Gabriella, maybe you can follow up with Lynn. Her email address is there on screen, and I encourage everyone, go check out the book. You can learn more at changequestions.net. Again, the free workbook, Lynn, thank you for providing that. And then the full book that is also available.
And it's audiobook and Kindle. John reads some parts, so you can get, it's all on Amazon.
Great. Well, I hope people will go and find that. Lynn, great job today. There are a lot of thank yous and great job messages in the chat. So definitely amplify that. And, thank you for doing this today. You had shared it was your first webinar. You would never know that. You did a great
job. Good.
You did a great job. Thank you for thank you for being part of our series. And thank you, everybody, for attending and participating. Hopefully we will see you December 5th, our next webinar in the series. People are saying very informative, great presentation. I enjoyed the session. Great topic. Join us on December 5th. Stephanie Hill from KyNexus will be doing her webinar. Thanks again.